Swing.
Blog Talk Radio.
And the Daily Machine intervened and demanded that Washington cut off.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power. Yes, yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal...
Thank you.
come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time.
Bye.
who have been pushed out of overcrowded ghetto schools and obtaining basically literacy skills prerequisite to receiving jobs. We had an agreement with A&P stores for 750 jobs through FCLC's job program, Operation Breadbasket, and had recruited over 500 pupils the first week. At that point, Congressman Kuczynski and the Daily Machine intervened and demanded that Washington cut off our funds or channel them through the machine-controlled poverty program in Chicago. Now we have no problem with administrative supervision, but we do have a desire to be independent of machine control and the Democratic Party patronage network. But this desire for a politically independent approach to the needs of our brothers, our funds are being stopped as of September 15th, and a very meaningful program discontinued. Yes, the hour is dark. Evil comes forth in the guise of good. It is a time of double talk when men in high places have a high blood pressure of deceptive rhetoric and an anemia of concrete performance. We crowd against welfare handouts to the poor, but generously approve an oil depletion allowance to make the rich richer. Six Mississippi plantations receive more than $1 million a year not to plant cotton, but no provision is made to feed the tenant farmer who is put out of work by the government subsidy. Crowning achievement in hypocrisy must go to those staunch Republicans and Democrats of the Midwest and West who were given land by our government when they came here as immigrants from Europe. They were given education through the land-grant colleges. They were provided with agricultural agents to keep them abreast of farming trends. They were granted low-interest loans to aid in the mechanization of their farms. And now that they have succeeded in becoming successful, they are paid not to farm. And these are the same people who now say to black people whose ancestors were brought to this country in chains and who were emancipated in 1863 without being given land to cultivate or bread to eat, that they must pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. What they truly advocate is socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. I wish that I could say that this is just a passing phase in the cycle of our nation's life. Certainly times of war, times of reaction throughout the society. But I suspect that we are now experiencing the coming to the surface of a triple-pronged sickness that has been lurking within our body politic from its very beginning. That is the sickness of racism, excessive materialism, and militarism. Not only is this our nation's dilemma, it is the plague of Western civilization. As early as 1906, W.E.B. Du Bois prophesied that the problem of the 20th century will be the problem of the color line. Now, as we stand two-thirds into this crucial period of history, we know full well that racism is still that hound of hell which dogs the tracks of our civilization. Ever since the birth of our nation, white America has had a schizophrenic personality on the question of race. She has been torn between selves, a self in which she proudly professed the great principles of democracy, and a self in which she madly practiced the antithesis of democracy. This tragic duality has produced a strange indecisiveness and ambivalence toward the Negro, causing America to take a step backward simultaneously with every step forward on the question of racial justice, to be at once attracted to the Negro and repelled by him, to love and to hate him. There has never been a solid, unified, and determined thrust to make justice a reality for Afro-Americans. A step backward has a new name today. It is called the white backlash. But the white backlash is nothing new. It is the surfacing of old prejudices, hostilities, and ambivalences that have always been there. It was caused neither by the cry of black power, nor by the unfortunate recent wave of riots in our cities. The white backlash of today is rooted in the same problem that has characterized America ever since the black man landed in chains on the shores of this nation. This does not imply that all white Americans are racist. Far from it, many white people have, through a deep moral compulsion, fought long and hard for racial justice. Nor does it mean that America has made no progress in her attempt to cure the body politic of the disease of racism, or that the dogma of racism has not been considerably modified in recent years. However, for the good of America, it is necessary to refute the idea that the dominant ideology in our country, even today, is freedom and equality, while racism is just an occasional departure from the norm on the part of a few bigoted extremists. Racism can well be that corrosive evil that will bring down the curtain on Western civilization. Arnold Toynbee has said that some 26 civilizations have risen upon the face of the earth. Almost all of them have descended into the junk heaps of destruction. The decline and fall of these civilizations, according to Toynbee, was not caused by external invasions, but by internal decay. They failed to respond creatively to the challenges impinging upon them. If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men. The second aspect of our afflicted society is extreme materialism. An Asian writer has portrayed our dilemma in candid terms. He says, "You call your 1,000 material devices labor-saving machinery, yet you are forever busy. With the multiplying of your machinery, you grow increasingly fatigued, anxious, nervous, dissatisfied. Whatever you have, you want more. wherever you are, you want to go somewhere else. Your devices are neither time-saving nor soul-saving machinery. There are so many sharp spurs which urge you on to invent more machinery and to do more business. This tells us something about our civilization that cannot be cast aside as a prejudiced charge by an Eastern thinker who is jealous of Western prosperity. We cannot escape the indictment. This does not mean that we must turn back the clock of scientific progress. No one can overlook the wonders that science has wrought for our lives. The automobile will not abdicate in favor of the horse and buggy, of the train in favor of the stagecoach, of the tractor in favor of the hand plow, of the scientific method in favor of ignorance and superstition. But our moral lag must be redeemed. When scientific power outruns moral power, we end up with guided missiles and misguided men. When we foolishly maximize the minimum and minimize the maximum, we sign the warrant for our own day of doom. It is this moral lag in our thing-oriented society that blinds us to the human realities around us and encourages us in the greed and exploitation which create the sector of poverty in the midst of wealth. Again, we have deluded ourselves into believing the myth that capitalism grew and prospered out of the Protestant ethic of hard work and sacrifice. The fact is that capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves. Continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both black and white, both here and abroad. If Negroes and poor whites do not participate in the free flow of wealth within our economy, they will forever be poor, giving their energy, their talents, and their limited funds to the consumer market, but reaping few benefits and services in return. The way to end poverty is to end the exploitation of the poor. Ensure them a fair share of the government services and the nation's resources. I proposed recently that a national agency be established to provide employment for everyone needing it. Nothing is more socially inexcusable than unemployment in this age. In the 30s, when the nation was bankrupt, it instituted such an agency, the WPA. In the present conditions of a nation glutted with resources, it is barbarous to condemn people desiring work for soul-sapping inactivity and poverty. I am convinced that even this one massive act of concern would do more than all the state police and armies of the nation to quell riots and steal hatreds. The tragedy is that our materialistic culture does not possess the statesmanship necessary to do it. Victor Hugo could have been thinking of 20th century America when he wrote, "There's always more misery among the lower classes than there is humanity in the higher classes." The time has come for America to face the inevitable choice between materialism and humanism. We must devote at least as much to our children's education and the health of the poor
as we do to the care of our automobiles and the building of beautiful, impressive hotels. We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power. We must further recognize that the ghetto is a domestic colony. Black people must develop programs that will aid in the transfer of power and wealth into the hands of residents of the ghetto so that they may in reality control their own destiny. This is the meaning of new politics. People of goodwill in the larger community must support the black man in this effort. The final phase of our national sickness is the disease of militarism. Nothing more clearly demonstrates our nation's abuse of military power than our tragic adventure in Vietnam. This war has played havoc with the destiny of the entire world. It has torn up the Geneva Agreement. It has seriously impaired the United Nations. It has exacerbated the hatred between continents and, worse still, between races. It has frustrated our development of home at home. Telling our own underprivileged citizens that we place insatiable military demands above our most critical needs. It has greatly contributed to the forces of reaction in America and strengthened the military-industrial complex. And it has practically destroyed Vietnam and left thousands of American and Vietnamese youth maimed and mutilated, and exposed the whole world to the risk of nuclear warfare. Above all, the war in Vietnam has revealed what Senator Fulbright calls our nation's arrogance of power. We are arrogant in professing to be concerned about the freedom of foreign nations while not setting our own house in order. Many of our senators and congressmen vote joyously to appropriate billions of dollars for the war in Vietnam. And many of these same senators and congressmen vote loudly against a fair housing bill to make it possible for a Negro veteran of Vietnam to purchase a decent home. We arm Negro soldiers to kill on foreign battlefields, but offer little protection for their relatives from beatings and killings in our own South. We are willing to make the Negro 100% of a citizen in warfare, but reduce him to 50% of a citizen on American soil. No war in our nation's history has ever been so violative of our conscience, our national interests, and so destructive of our moral standing before the world. No enemy has ever been able to cause such damage to us as we inflict upon ourselves. The inexorable decay of our urban centers has flared into terrifying domestic conflict, as the pursuit of foreign war absorbs our wealth and energy. Squalor and poverty scar our cities, as our military might destroys cities
in a far-off land to support oligarchy to intervene in domestic conflict. The president who cherishes consensus for peace has intensified the war. In answer to a cry to stop the war, it has brought tauntingly to 1 minute's flying time from China, to a moment before the midnight of world conflagration. We are offered a tax for war instead of a plan for peace. Men of reason should no longer debate the merits of war or means of financing war. They should end the war and restore sanity and humanity to American policy. If the will of the people continues to be unheeded, all men of goodwill must create a situation in which the 1967-68 elections are made a referendum on the war. The American people must have an opportunity to vote into oblivion those who cannot detach themselves from militarism. And so we are here because we believe, we hope, we pray that something new might emerge in the political life of this nation, which will produce a new man, new structures and institutions, and a new life for mankind. I'm convinced that this new life will not emerge until our nation undergoes a radical revolution of values. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, economic exploitation and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A civilization can flounder as readily in the face of moral bankruptcy as it can through financial bankruptcy. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. We are called to play the Good Samaritans on life's roadside, but that will only be an initial act. One day the whole Jericho road must be transformed so that men and women will not be beaten and robbed as they make that journey through life. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It understands that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look at thousands of working people displaced from their jobs with reduced income as a result of automation, while the profits of the employers remain intact, and say, this is not just. It will look across the oceans and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia and Africa only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say, this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say, this is not just. True revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples nominally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped, and psychologically deranged cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. So what we must all see is that these are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation. And out of the wounds of a frail world, new systems and of justice and equality are being born. The shirtless and barefoot people of the earth are rising up as never before. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to
intensive way, we'd be true to the facts. We must admit that the whole nation has come a long, long way in extending the frontiers of civil rights. 50 years ago, and point even 25 years ago, a year hardly passed when numerous Negroes were not brutally lynched by some vicious mob in the South. But lynchings have about ceased today. This reveals that we've made some strides. At the turn of the century, there were very few Negroes registered to vote in the South. By 1948, that number had leaped to 750,000. By 1960, that number had leaped to 1,200,000. It is still going up in spite of opposition. This reveals that some progress has been made. Even in the economic area, we've seen some developments. The average Negro wage earner who happens to be employed today earns 10 times more than the average Negro wage earner 12 years ago, and the national income of the Negro is now at about $30 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States and more than the national budget of Canada. This reveals that there has been some progress on this level. But probably more than anything else, we've seen in our day and in our age the gradual breakdown of the system of legal segregation. We all know the history of this system. It had its legal beginning in 1896. And the Supreme Court of the nation rendered what was known as the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, establishing the doctrine of separate but equal as the law of the land. And we all know what happened as a result of the Plessy doctrine. There was always a strict enforcement of the separate, without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. The Negro ended up being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where he experienced the bleakness of nagging injustice. Then in 1954, Supreme Court of our nation examined the legal body of segregation and on May 17th pronounced it constitutionally dead. Said in substance that the old Plessy doctrine must go, that separate facilities are inherently unequal, and that to segregate a child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. So since surrendering of that decision, we've seen numerous developments in our country. Then along with this, almost 10 years later, our nation passed a comprehensive civil rights bill, passed on July 2nd, 1964, signed happy to report that communities all across the South, even in the hardcore South, are complying with that civil rights bill, particularly the public accommodation section, with amazing good sense and reasonableness. This reveals that we are making some strides. So to put it figuratively in biblical language, we've broken loose from the Egypt of slavery. We have moved through the wilderness of legal segregation, and now we stand on the border of the promised land of integration. Now, I'm absolutely convinced that the system of segregation is on its deathbed today, and the only thing uncertain about it is how costly the segregationists will make the funeral. We've come a long, long way since 1896. Now, this would be a wonderful place for me to end my speech. First, it would mean making a relatively short speech, and that would be a magnificent accomplishment for a Baptist preacher. Secondly, it would mean that the problem is about solved, and it would be a marvelous thing if speakers all over our country could talk about this problem in terms of a problem that once existed but that no longer has existed. But if I stop at this point, I will merely be stating a fact and not telling the truth. See, a fact is merely the absence of contradiction. The truth is the presence of coherence. Truth is the relatedness of fact. Now, it's a fact that we've come a long, long way, but it isn't the whole truth. And I'm afraid if I stop at this point, I will leave you the victims of a dangerous optimism. If I stop at this point, I may send you away the victims of an illusion wrapped in superficiality. So in order to tell the truth, it is necessary to move on and say, not only we've come a long, long way, we have a long, long way to go before the problem of racial injustice is solved. I don't think I have to stay on this point too long. We need only turn on our televisions and open our newspapers and look around in our communities. We know that no section of our country can boast of clean hands in the area of brotherhood. I mentioned the fact that lynchings have about ceased. We must see the other side. Brutal murders are still taking place. Think of the three civil rights workers murdered in Mississippi last summer. Nothing has been done about. In the state of Alabama, under the administration of Governor George Wallace, exactly 10 Negroes and their white supporters have been brutally murdered. Nobody has been convicted for a single murder. Churches are being burned and bombed. In Mississippi, it seems now that they have a new motto, not attend the church of your choice, but burn the church of your choice. Oh, how tragic this is. All of this reminds us that injustice still stalks the land, tragic lawlessness we find in so many of its dimensions. Alabama is still a state. Mississippi is still a state. Louisiana, and I could go right on, where murder is a sort of favorite pastime. Reign of terror, the Klan continues its ugly activities. All of this comes to remind us that we have a long, long way to go. I mentioned the fact that we had made some strides in the area of voter registration. We now have a little more than 2 million Negroes registered in the South. Now that looks fairly well, but when you think of the fact that there are still a little more than 10 million Negroes who still live in the South, about 6 million are voting age, only about 2 million registered, which means there are 4 million Negroes in the South who are not registered to vote. And it isn't only because of apathy, but like the from becoming registered voters. Face intimidation when they go to the courthouse. They are harassed. They face economic reprisal. I was in Selma just last week, only to discover that a few more than 200 Negroes have been fired from their jobs simply because they went down to the courthouse to register and vote. Most of them are instant households. Think of the little children who will go hungry. Think of the wives, the mothers who will go hungry, who will not have the basic necessities of life simply because they wanted to register and vote, something that is sacred in our great nation and our democratic government. This reminds us that we have a long, long way to go. Then the complex literacy test still being given. The other day I studied the one they give in Alabama very thoroughly. I'm absolutely convinced that Chief Justice Warren would flunk it in the first minute of picking it up. Questions are so absurd on that and so ridiculous and so complicated. A person with a PhD in any field, a person with a law degree from the finest law school of our nation, not answer them. This is what we still face. So this reveals that we still have a long, long way to go on the voting front. I mentioned economic justice, and I gave a big figure, $30 billion as figure that tells us about the annual income and buying power of the Negro. When we look at the other side, it tells us that we still have a great deal of work to do. But that other side reminds us that 42% of the Negro families of our country still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 17% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year. 21% of the Negro families of our country still earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 5% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. 88% of the Negro families of our country still earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. This reveals to us that we have a long, long way to go. Another problem has come into being because of the social injustices, the neglect of the past. We have inherited a difficult problem in every major city of our country. The Negro been denied educational opportunities in so many instances. And covered up in ghettos, crowded and overcrowded, woefully inadequate schools. So he was denied the opportunity in many instances, denied the opportunity for an apprenticeship training. For this reason, we have been limited by and large to semi-skilled and unskilled labor. Now, of course, called automation, cybernation, came into being. These are the jobs that are passing away. Pounds the problem that the Negro confronts because he faces the double blow of outright discrimination in employment and the displacement of the sociological changes that are developing as a result of automation. CERN society must do something about this. Massive public works programs, massive retraining programs must come into being in order to grapple with this problem. For when people are walking the streets hungry, they have no job. They see life as a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. They become bitter. That is nothing more dangerous for any society than to develop a large segment of that society and leave them with the feeling that they have no stake in the society, that they Davis Corps are always on hand with their oxygen tents to keep the whole order alive. We have to face the fact that segregation is still with us. Still having hardcore bombs in some parts of the South. We still have it in its de facto expression. Almost every state and city of our union. I'm absolutely convinced that if democracy is to live, segregation must die. Segregation is a cancer in the body politic, which must be removed before our moral health can be realized. So the great challenge facing America is to get rid of racial segregation in all of its dimensions. This must be done not merely to meet the communist challenge, important as this happens to be. It must be done not merely to have a good image in the world, and we want this image. We must have it. It must be done not merely to appeal to Asian and African peoples, and the final analysis, racial injustice must be uprooted from American society because it is morally wrong. Segregation is evil, to use the words of the great Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, because it substitutes an I-it relationship for the I-thou relationship. Go back to the thinking of St. Thomas Aquinas. It is evil because it is based on human law, that out of harmony with the moral, the natural, and the eternal laws of the universe. Somewhere the Protestant theologian Paul Tillich has said that sin is separation. What is racial segregation but an existential expression of man's tragic estrangement? This awful separation, horrible thing. So we must solve this problem, not merely because it is diplomatically expedient, but because it is morally compelling. This is a great challenge facing America. Not in order to do it, in order to solve the problem, we've got to develop massive action programs all over the nation. This problem will not work itself out. We must work at it on a day-to-day basis. Now, to develop this kind of action program, we've got to get rid of one or two myths that are constantly disseminated around our nation. One is the myth of time. Now, you've heard this, I'm sure. There are those people who contend that only time can solve the problem. They say to the Negro and his allies in the white communities, let's be patient. Don't push things too fast. And wait 100 to 200 years. Time will work it out. I think there's an answer to this myth. It is that time is literal. It can be used either constructively or destructively. I hate to say that I'm absolutely convinced forces of ill will of our nation, forces committed to negative ends of our nation, the extreme rightists of our nation, have often used time much more effectively than the people and the forces of goodwill. It may well be that we will have to repent in this generation.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved.
The people who sit around and say, wait on time, somewhere.